Welcome to Worst Year Ever, a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome to the worst year ever. We'll get through it together or not. Everything is so dumb, 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 dumb.
Boy, this year, huh? Not a good one.
It is one, though. It's a year.
It is a year. It is a year.
So.
And it could either be the best or the worst year ever still, because there's days left in it. So, like, you know, a variety of things could occur. But at
the
moment...
We could still turn this thing around.
Yep. There's still
of
time.
Of the years I've experienced, certainly the worst. That's the podcast name. Of the years I've experienced, certainly the worst. This one is.
It's punchy.
Yeah, very
quick to the point.
Good, mm-hmm. The way you're supposed to write things.
You want the long titles for podcasts. That's
yeah,
what people, that's what grabs people.
As indirect and obfuscated as possible. That's mm-hmm. what helps
as
you to communicate.
As long as it does not fit in your podcast art, you're doing it right.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Since the title doesn't fit.
Meander as much as you can, like intros.
Like
this intro.
Yeah.
So, introduction-wise, I'm Robert Evans, and we've also got a Katie Stoll here, and we've got
yep.
a Cody Johnston. And
true.
We're all talking about the world in which we live. But it's not just us this time, thank God, because I'm tired of us, right? Are you tired of us?
I'm exhausted. Tired.
I'm not tired of any of you. I love all of you.
That's
nice. I see this bit and I like it. It's fun, Robert. But if I'm being perfectly honest, I look forward to seeing you guys.
I know.
Well, that's very sweet, but it does ruin my joke. So it's time for us to bring in our guest for today, who I'm very excited to talk to. Jeremiah Ellison, who is a city council member in Minneapolis, Ward 5, as well as a political organizer and a visual artist. And Jeremiah, welcome to the thing that we do that is in your ears, but is not the radio somehow.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me. I'm excited. Been listening to Behind the Bastards and was listening to Behind the Police and heard Minneapolis mentioned a couple of times and obviously have been involved in all the stuff we're doing here locally. So it was interesting to hear it sort of distilled through your lens and I think you got it spot on. So I reached out and just thought I'd let you know, like, listening to Behind the Police was weirdly affirming, even though, I wouldn't call it like feel good, material.
Right.
Yeah. You sent me that message, which really helped on a dark day because they're mostly dark days in Portland right about now.
Yeah.
I started thinking like, you know, for all that I care about this, I know that y'all in Minneapolis in the city council have voted to like, Let's get rid of these police.
We're trying.
Yeah. That was like the headline that I read earlier. And then like
right.
I read other headlines. It's like, it's actually harder than that to do.
For
because,
sure.
Yeah. So I figured we'd bring you on because like, first off, I want to know like, what's going on with that?
Yeah.
Point of like, I'm curious, you know, kind of since you've been inside this, what it was like leading up to and getting, you know, having a vote on that, on whether or not to kind of replace your police force with something else. And then sort of what's happened since and like what things have been kind of thrown in your way and blocked sort of the route that you like. I know that it's a fascinating story and you have been there for it, which really makes things easier on me.
You know, I think that what you can say in a headline is often obviously not the whole picture. And so I'll try to do my fastest version of the like long version, which won't take too long. But essentially, you know, we had a number of constituents, a number of activists in the community of Minneapolis who during the uprising said, hey, look, we think that there's this huge not just problem with the Minneapolis police, but we think there's a huge inherent problem with the nature of policing, how we do policing, how we conduct public safety. We think a lot of you on the city council agree with us, and we're looking for you all to sort of affirm publicly that you agree with your constituents who feel this way. And so, you know, I actually was at that time doing a number of community like patrols, right, myself. Like as the council member, I was out all night you know, there were a lot of talk of white supremacist stuff, and so I didn't know how many of my colleagues were going to show up to the park that day. There ended up being 9 of us, and we sort of affirmed that we agreed that the nature of policing is flawed, and that we really need to we're interested in being on the front line of dismantling that system and creating something different for public safety. What followed was kind of a number of really kind of boring small steps. One was a resolution basically affirming that public commitment that we made in the park, that we are looking to replace, dismantle, radically change our method of public safety within the city. One of the ways in which we are blocked from making any changes is via our city charter. For folks who don't know, a city charter is basically like the municipal local constitution. So we're sort of in our own way. And so our first step really after passing a resolution, and a resolution is basically just like it's a promise. It can either mean something or not mean something depending on your follow through. After passing the resolution, we went to go change the charter, and we ran into the charter commission and I think also a lot of backlash within the community that was really pushing to sort of slow the brakes and say, hey, look, you know, we know that people want radical change, but we think maybe that shouldn't happen. And the Charter Commission is an unelected body. They are, you know, they are entitled via state statute to make the decision that they made. The decision that they made, by the way, was to delay the vote on our amendment. So the City Council put together a resolution to change the charter, which would have to go onto the ballot for the people to vote. Before it ends up on the ballot, the Charter Commission, which is this appointed body, has to review the language and refer it back to the City Council. Now, the City Council can still put it on the ballot even if the Charter Commission doesn't think we should, but the Charter Commission has to get us a recommendation. They decided to run out the clock, so to speak. They never gave us a recommendation back, and which meant that we could not vote to put it on the ballot.
That sounds like democracy.
Yeah, that seems like how it's supposed to go.
I was halfway through describing it where I was like, I'm missing steps, which, wow, I'm saying a lot and I'm still missing steps.
You're doing a great job. That's a lot of information.
So that's where we are now. I think that a part of how we got there was that, so we tried to do this back in 2018 when I first got onto the council. So I was elected in November of 2017, for those that don't know, and started my term in 2018. And it was one of the first things we did was try to change the charter. We were trying to make a less significant change. I think we basically wanted the council to be able to write policies for the police. As it stands, the Minneapolis City Council has no authority over the police. And so it's just the mayor has complete authority over the police department. So we tried to change the charter back in 2018. And we were sort of outmaneuvered by this narrative that, like, oh, you know, how is a police chief ever going to function with 13 bosses, 13 bosses? Everybody was saying how, like, it would be chaos if we had a public safety system that was managed by 13 bosses, which is how every other department in the city is run, by the way. And I think that, like, you know, the roads get plowed and, like, potholes get filled and, you know, the trash gets taken out, fine, right? But for police, it's apparently not an appropriate system to have. That's all we were trying to do in 2018. You know, public opinion wasn't with us then. And so it was something we largely, I think, as a council let go. And then obviously with the murder of George Floyd, our inability to really create policy and manage the police or have authority over the police came rushing back to our face and was like, okay, you had the right instincts in 2018. You need to start pursuing this again. So that's what we started doing. But we were a little late to... We were a little late to proposing it, which is what allowed the Charter Commission to run out the clock.
Wow. So what are the next steps for this?
So I think that we're...
Who's on the Charter Commission? Like, I don't understand, like, that. So the Charter Commission,
it's an unelected body. It's sort of... it was put together via state statute to say, you know, if you're going to make change to your city's charter, you've got to have... essentially, a panel full of supposed experts that vet whether or not your charter change is appropriate for the charter, or whether what you want to enshrine in charter should actually be an ordinance or whatever.
So conceptually, it sounds good, but in reality, Who's that? Who specifically for you, who is on? Is it a bunch of old white guys? Like, I don't understand. Like, that was what I was trying.
Yes. It's a bunch of older, and in some cases, very old, white men, mostly some older white women. There were two members, I think, were like folks of color, newer, younger folks of color. But again, they're appointed by a single judge, the entire commission. And so, and then what we learned in this process was that the Charter Commission actually isn't full of folks who are experts in city charters, right? These are folks who are interested, willing to volunteer their time, and every once in a while get to have a lot of power. They mostly oversee municipal ward boundaries after every census.
So, what are the next? Sorry. Yeah, you guys are fine.
So I think we want to tee this up for 2021, propose it early enough to where the Charter Commission can't run out the clock. You know, again, with the Charter Commission can, if we can propose language, the Charter Commission can send it back to us saying, don't put this on the ballot, and we can put it on the ballot anyway. But they do have to give us a recommendation.
Yeah.
And so I think that the plan is to propose this with enough time which doesn't allow the Charter Commission to run out the clock, and we can get this for the 2021 ballot. I do think that presents a different kind of challenge. I don't know how much time you guys spend interacting with like elected officials, of which I am one.
Yeah.
But I would say that I'm worried that some of my colleagues won't want to have this on the ballot when they're on the ballot.
Yes.
Right.
And while I think that that's, you know, my personal opinion is that's ridiculous, but it is something that could go from, okay, this is a unanimously passed thing, to all of a sudden it's really in jeopardy, right?
Right.
That can happen with people making the kinds of political calculus they make.
Well, especially since this first push, or not first, as you have explained, but right now, this moment in time is fueled so much by George Floyd, by the protests, by the nationwide attention, by all of this. And so this decision was made. Unfortunately, all this stuff happened. But yes, the next time it comes on the ballot, who knows what public opinion looks like? Who knows? Everything changes so quickly.
Right. The pressure's off, are people gonna rise to the occasion? I think that's a valid question. You know, I like to think that I try to govern in a way to where I don't have to make those kinds of calculations. You mentioned I'm a visual artist, and like, you know, every day it just sort of baffles me that I'm not like drawing comics right now, and which is what I love doing. But I think this is important work. I'm not willing to sort of sacrifice what I think is the right thing to do in order to keep this job, in large part because, you know, if I don't keep this job, I go back to drawing comics, and that's not a bad case scenario for me.
What made you decide to run for office in the first place?
So I grew up, born and raised in North Minneapolis, which, if folks don't have context, that's sort of like the black neighborhood of Minneapolis. When a couple of years ago, in 2015, a neighbor of mine, who I didn't know him personally, but actually had some connection with his older siblings. His sister used to do my sister's hair, actually. But Jamar Clark was murdered by the Minneapolis police. This is before I was in office. And so this is somebody in my neighborhood killed blocks away from where I grew up, and I was down at the protests every day. At that time, I wasn't really super neck deep into activism. Obviously, my parents have always been involved in politics, and I've always had some proximity to politics and activism. But I myself was in my studio most days. And the death of Jamar Clark sort of brought me out of my studio and to the protest. You know, after those the protests sort of ended around Jamar Clark, I know I had probably done more engagement with City Hall at that time than I'd ever done. I got a project working. I got a commission to do a project in City Hall as an artist, and I was working with one of the city departments, and I learned a lot about the city in that time as well. And I guess the short version is that learning so much about municipal government, being really disillusioned and disappointed with my representative at the time, I thought, you know what, and having a lot of community members ask me to run sort of pushed me into running. And I really, my goal was to address gentrification more than anything, which is, you know, economic displacement and everything. But obviously, this issue around policing and community safety is a huge one, and it's definitely sort of dominated my time in office, especially these last couple of months. Yeah.
Welcome to the worst year ever. We'll get through it together or not. Everything is so dumb, 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 dumb.
Was there a kind of understanding when, you know, the George Floyd was murdered and the protests start up? Was there a kind of understanding at all that, like, police violence kind of has to be the thing that we pivot on right now? Like, not just for Minneapolis, but because, like, we're kind of in a position to set an example for the rest of the country? Like, was there any sort of, like, feeling of that? Or were you kind of totally focused on sort of dealing with you know, the immediate issues in front of you?
Yeah, I think that the national and maybe even global conversation really was like, we tried to not make it front and center in our minds, right? You know, a part of it is that some of this work that we were advocating, we knew these problems existed, I guess, in short.
Sure.
You know, we had just since I've been in office, the police have been caught injecting people with ketamine, you know, as they're being arrested for no other reason than, like, maybe they mouthed off to a cop or something, right? And the cop tells the MT to inject that person with ketamine until they're totally inebriated against their will. So that was a scandal when I first got in office.
That's protecting and serving.
Yeah.
We had a drug sting conducted that was considered to be so riddled with, like, racial bias that the county prosecutor wouldn't prosecute any of the charges, right? It was, like, massive drug sting, and I don't know how much you know about, like, Mike Freeman, but he's not, like, you know, he's not, like, an activist, prosecutor, but he looked at this case and he said, okay, there's so much racial bias here, I can't prosecute this case. We've had, our police department got caught lying about the number of untested rape kits they had. They had something like 10 times more the number that they reported to the state. And so, like, we've had these issues, right, like, with the police department. And so I think the murder of George Floyd, like, I think it for a lot of my colleagues, me and Steve Fletcher and Lisa Bender and Philippe Cunningham, we've kind of been like, and Cam Gordon, we've kind of been like the leftist candidates who, like, every year we're trying to pull a little bit of money out of the police department. Every year we maybe have enough for a little bit. Maybe we don't have the votes to get anything passed. But all of a sudden, for the rest of my colleagues, I think the urgency of this issue just came rushing forward. And it was like, oh, no, we've got a much more massive issue than I think a lot of my colleagues were willing to acknowledge.
Yeah. Can you walk me through? I'm very curious, like, that first meeting y'all had after the uprising started, right? After the these protests start to sweep through Minneapolis and kind of spread virally around the country. What is your first day back together with that as your new reality like? Did that just kind of, like, swamp everything that was sort of on the table temporarily? Like, what was? Yeah, I'm really curious, like, what it was like to be in that room.
This might sound pretty weird. So we don't have, like, session, right? We're just sort of working all year, but periodically, four times during 4 weeks out of the year that aren't together. They're sort of sprinkled out through the year. We have a week where there's no meeting, there's no committee meetings, no council meeting. So, and it's called, like, a ward week. And often this is when council members will, like, take that, you know, they'll take their trip up to Duluth or whatever. So George Floyd was killed during a ward week, which meant that we went an unusual amount of time without a committee meeting, without a council meeting, without meeting at all, right? Because we just didn't have, we just happened to not have any meetings that week. And so so it felt like forever. It actually felt like forever. It almost felt like it, like, you know, especially with me doing night patrols, like, during the day, I'm doing interviews with, like, local news and national news. I'm going to the protests. And at night, I'm either out doing patrols or whatever. So I wasn't sleeping at all. And so that week ended up feeling like a month. And I think that when we finally did come back together as a council, it felt like it had been a long time, even though it probably hadn't. And so we passed that resolution. I remember that much. We ended up passing that resolution saying that we're going to replace the police department. And I think we tried to set in motion a few things. And then we also had to do a budget revision of the 2020 budget because we're facing this shortfall due to coronavirus. And so all of those things ended up sort of hitting us at the same time. And so and we're disconnected from each other. All of our council meetings are exactly like this. We're not in the chamber like we usually are. So I think it felt like a little surreal, but I don't remember the meeting being particularly like noteworthy other than the fact that we passed that resolution. Wow.
And you know, one of the things that's been interesting to me here in Portland is, you know, it happened a little later for us when we became like the big national story, but we've had a couple of different periods of that now. And it's among other things involved taking like communities within our city and putting them in the national spotlight. And suddenly everybody, all these people, you know, and have been working with are on CNN and NBC and the New York Times. And like, it's very surreal. It happened to all of the Portland journalists, like the local reporters I've been working with. And now it's happening to all of our like local far right and fascist activists after Jay Danielson was shot.
Yeah.
And it's very weird. These like little communities that like had never really been that prominent suddenly being like at the center of the national conversation for like 4 days, right? Like that's how it tends to work.
Right.
And the same thing happened to y'all. I'm wondering, you know, because that story, once like you voted, you know, replace the police department, like that was the one of the biggest stories in the country for days, in a way that almost nothing is anymore. What was it like getting all of that attention directed on all of you, and how did it sort of impact y'all's, you know, ability to do what you were trying to do, like to actually do your jobs?
Yeah, well, you know, there are two groups here. One's called Reclaim the Block, and another one's Black Visions Collective, who, as far as the defund movement goes, you know, they were these tiny volunteer organizations back in 2018 who were advocating that we take money out of the police then. And so they've just sort of been marching along as the years go by, making the same demand year after year while getting very little attention. And so here we were in this moment that was really, I think, vindicating for these organizing groups. And I think that a lot of my colleagues recognized that we had been getting pushed by these local organizations that entire time. And we were trying our best to center their advocacy in the conversation. And so I know that, you know, they did get covered a lot. And they were, you know, Black Visions Collective was featured on the cover of the New York Times, the New York Times and everything. And so that certainly happened. And all of that stuff is sort of complicated because in some ways we were getting a lot of attention. It was overwhelming. All my colleagues were on, you know, we were on like national, you know, MSNBC and CNN or whatever, which is like this weird sort of cycle that eats your time and eventually, and is exciting at first and eventually just feels all not that fruitful. But you're also not leaving your house the entire time, right? Like for the most part. And so it weirdly feels like a lot and like very little at the same time, if that makes sense. So, because you're social distancing, you're not leaving the house. And aside from doing the nightly patrols, I wasn't really leaving the house all that much. So,
yeah. And what's next? Like, how do you, if this is like, this is the dream, this is the goal, like replace your police department.
Yep.
What are you going to do next? Like, what has to be done next in order to actually make this happen? How do you stop this from kind of turning into one of those things that sort of dies on the vine? Like, right?
Yeah,
that's
for
obviously,
sure.
I think what kind of the opposition to it hopes will happen is that if they can slow it down long enough, people won't have the focus to see it through, which, you know, there's a good chance they're right. That's how America works. Generally,
for sure.
We lose the thread and forget to do, or a Kennedy gets shot or whatever. And like, yeah, we stop, you know, doing the thing that we were doing and go back to pretending nothing needs to be
Everything's
done.
Everything's fine. Right.
Yeah. How do you stop? How do you stop that from happening here?
Yeah. I think that in large part, a part of why I ended up messaging you actually was because I think I have been feeling that a little bit, right? Like that this slow death that happens when you try to do something bold, you hit a few stumbling blocks, and now it's just sort of like this slow death march, right? I think that the way that we prevent that from happening is a few things. One is our local activist base, I think, is going to remain active, right? They have been year after year. They didn't just spring onto the scene after the murder of George Floyd. They've been in council chambers every year sort of making this demand. And now they've got a lot of wind under their sails, and I'm hoping that they take advantage of that and continue to put pressure on the council. So that's one. I think for my part, as a council member, as an elected, I've got to go out and have a lot of conversations with constituents that maybe couldn't happen immediately after the murder of George Floyd. Because one of the things that is being politicized as a way to slow and derail this conversation is that, you know, every city in America has had sort of like a rise in violent incidences in crime, right? And so that, you know, a lot of what the local media has been publishing, you see these headlines from our local paper saying, you know, crime rises as council continues its path towards defunding the police. You know, homicides at a 5-year high as council looks to dismantle the police. And so they're trying to link this idea that somehow this increase in violent incidences is correlated with the council's demand that we do public safety differently.
Sure.
And
you're saying the same thing in Portland, too. Like, we got rid of our gun violence task force because it's horrifically violent. And gun violence has also spiked. And they're like, well, it's clearly because of this. And it's like, well, there's also a giant plague and everybody's out of work.
Everybody's
like, there's a lot of factors
like,
to take
there's a number of things that have happened.
Yeah. I mean, I was dealing with a week ago, I was, you know, I was advocating for, you know, working with our county to get this homeless shelter, because we also have this huge homeless encampment issue here in Minneapolis, and it's not our first one. And homelessness is increasing. It's been increasing every single year, but it's getting really bad because of coronavirus. You know, I was advocating that this abandoned building in my ward be used as a shelter, be converted into a shelter. And my constituents were just like, I mean, not all of them, obviously, but the ones who showed up to these public meetings and onto these Zoom calls, they were so against it. And obviously, I work for my constituents, and I have an incredible amount of respect for my constituents, but I just couldn't quite put two and two together with their argument. It was like people would get up there and say things like, you know, our children are dying, and you want to put a homeless shelter here. And it's like, how is that a sentence? Like that...
How does this homeless shelter affect this?
Right. Like how does this homeless shelter, right, exactly.
Those houseless people are someone's children, right?
That's how
humans work.
Right.
I find that interesting that, you know, as an elected official, reconciling something that you know to be good and important to you in your tenure versus also what your constituents are showing up to say. And not just that, I mean, the people that show up and are vocal are a subset of it. They're not necessarily what broader opinion is.
Right.
Right. They're the angrier ones are going to show up.
Always show up. Talk. Right. Yeah. Right. But, you know, we needed a couple different governmental bodies to play ball. I'm at the city. We were on board. The county was obviously on board. And the last sort of unit of government sort of chickened out and just was like, we're not going to, you know, and we needed all three in order to make the shelter happen. So I think that this whole narrative that like this conversation around public safety and the police and defunding the police is connected to violence. And then when people don't feel safe, then they kind of get that NIMBY impulse. And they're just like, no homeless shelter, no affordable housing, no poor people around me at all. Right. Like that's sort of like this weird gut reaction that some people have when they feel like their safety is under threat. And so, like, you know, to get kind of to your question, I think that, you know, obviously there's the nuts and bolts of what we have to do. But that whole conversation around the homeless shelter showed me it was kind of like a proxy conversation really about people feeling like secure. Right. Mm-hmm. And feeling like they have a voice. And it made me realize that, like, if we want to pull this off, you know, it's not impossible to persuade someone a constituent who comes to me and says, "Hey, council member, I don't understand why you're looking to defund the police when we are seeing this increase in violence." And I tend, on a one-on-one basis, I'm able to have those conversations pretty well, and I'm able to explain to them the logic, and I'm able to explain to them that, like, you know, that actually police don't enforce safety, that like that the entire structure of policing is in some ways built upon a lie that it keeps us safer. It eats up a lot of resources, and resources aren't unlimited. So when we're dropping, you know, 35-40% of our city budget into our policing institution, that does mean that other services can't happen, right? You know, it's not difficult to have a conversation with people. You know, folks will often say, "Oh, well, who's gonna solve rapes, right?" And like, yeah, our police department has an 80% no clearance rate on that, right? And so like 80%, nobody's doing that now. Yeah. And so if that's a way in which you expect to be kept safe, then you and I should talk about that, and we as a community need to come up with a structure that's actually going to keep you safe in that way. But police and policing is not it. Right. And so I think that we're going to have hundreds of those kinds of conversations. You know, some of it is encouraging. You know, I've been doing like these socially distanced backyard conversations in my ward, just because the you're so depersonalized on these Zoom calls that like people will just hijack your meeting and just scream into the abyss until everybody's frustrated and logs off. And so I've been doing them in person, even though it's a little bit more dangerous, but we've managed it. And I remember, you know, there's this one woman. I happen to have been born and raised in the ward that I live in. You know, I just have never moved. Some people move, and some of my colleagues are from different parts of the city or parts of the country, and they've made Minneapolis their home. This has been my home my entire life. And so I had this one constituent who was like, you know, "I've known you since you were, you know, 4 years old, and I feel bad saying this, but like, I can't support you anymore." Like, blah, 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 you know, and like was yelling at me. And then like a week later was like, pulled me aside at a different community meeting, was like, "You know what, Jeremiah, I hear what you're saying, and I get it." You know, like I'm slowly starting to get it. And so it's not impossible to win these arguments, but if we don't have, but we don't have the power of like a headline. We don't have the power of like, the political machine of like a police. Everybody will say they hate the police union, but then they'll gobble up the police union talking points, right? Mm-hmm. The media, everybody, you know. And so we just don't have those kinds of political machines that can churn out messaging. But those little conversations, if we can continue to have hundreds of them over the course of the next year, they do stick a little harder than a headline or sort of like people being bombarded with propaganda.
So do you still think there's hope for, you know, that thing that was the headline of Minneapolis no longer having the MPD? Is that a thing that you have hope for? Not in like the long, long run, but in, you know, a time frame that's not, you know, distant in the future.
Yeah, I think I do have hope for that. I think that, you know, and I also think that, and maybe this is like a little bleak, I don't mean to sound defeatist, but I also think that we could make a push here, push harder than anybody has ever pushed before, that, you know, that we sort of have a more centrist backlash in these local elections. Maybe all the leftists on the council lose their elections. We're up in 2021. And then the work is undone. But even that would be a success, because to me, if we can create an example that can even be pointed to later down the line for somebody to follow, that's a plus for me. Now, my hope is that we're going to get this done. We're going to establish the Office of Public Safety and Violence Prevention, and we're going to slowly start to shrink the footprint of the police while we beef up these other services with regards to mental health response and yada, yada, yada. I'm hoping that we can do that, start to do that work within the next year, year and a half. My hope was that we could do that work starting this November if we were able to get the charter amendment on the ballot, but with the charter as written, there's limits to how much we can shrink the police force. And so I think that there is hope for that. Obviously, with all of sort of the more left-leaning council members, you know, being on the ballot, if you know, if we all lose our elections, that'll tell us everything we need to know about how successful we were in persuading our constituents to go this direction with us.
No, I mean, I'm just curious when it comes to, because this is the thing we're also dealing with in Portland, right? Is like all of this is happening and everybody claims that the majority of people are on their side, right? The police yep. claim that like the right wing claims, you know, the left wing claims. You know, it's not like the presidential election. There's not a bunch of pollsters wandering around Minneapolis or Portland trying to figure out how people feel about this stuff, because that's just not pollsters go for like the big national shit.
Yep.
And so you're kind of in the dark. Do you have any? Is it really going to be a situation where, like, in 2021, we're just going to learn if we get reelected that they're on board or not? Do you have any other kind of like barometers that you're able to tell sort of where people are right now?
Yeah, a little bit. So one of the things is these are, you know, these positions are extremely local, right? Like, I represent in no uncertain terms my neighbors, right? Like, if you're a congressperson, right? Like, my congressperson is Ilhan Omar, who I love and I think is great. But like, Ilhan represents a large swath of people. She can't possibly know everybody in her who she represents, right? In Washington, D.C. I represent few enough people that I can kind of know a lot of them, right? And so that puts me in a position to, you know, so I might get, you know, a lot of folks, you know, at a community meeting, or by a lot, I mean like 15 or 20, saying one thing, right? Telling me that I shouldn't be pursuing this path. I might get a pastor that says, you know, this is crazy, Jeremiah. You know, the police, you know, one time the church was broken into and the police were helpful, right? But I'm also going to get like another pastor who says just the opposite. And when I'm walking my dog, in the morning, I'm going to get a ton of neighbors who just run out and tell me I'm doing a great job, right? So you represent few enough people in these positions to be able to get some sense. Mm-hmm. Your neighbors aren't pelting you with rocks as I walk my dog, and I take that as a good sign. So that's one way. We did have one of our local organizations reached out to an organization that does polling, and we do know that the prospective charter language was polling well, right? Now, does that mean that the charter language was not quite like a defund or abolish the police charter? That's not what it would have done. What the charter language would have done was allowed us a lot of flexibility to take public safety in different directions. And it was polling well, and we do know that, right? And so I think that those are some of the things that are sort of continuing to give me hope about, you know, how people are feeling. But by and large, I do think it'll be hard to know how people are feeling until 2021 local elections. I'm very rooted in my ward because I grew up here. But you know, it's hard to know. If one of my colleagues who's sort of, I would say more on the left, if even one of them loses their election, all of a sudden, you know, I think it becomes a lot harder for us to mount this progressive push on a consistent basis.
Welcome to the worst year ever. We'll get through it together or not. Everything is so dumb, 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 dumb.
So, yeah, I mean, we are to some extent just sort of waiting to learn if people like what you're trying to do and you get to do it. So it's the kind of thing, if you get reelected in 2021, you have a lot more power to actually push this through to the end and make this shit happen.
Yeah, I can basically take that as like a mandate from the people. Whereas I'm operating a lot on instinct, you know.
Right, right, right. And, you know, in completely unprecedented times, which I just want to say, you know, from the perspective of someone who is watching a guy, like I'm looking at like our mayor here in Portland, who is a feckless coward. I can say as an objective journalist, right? Like that's not an opinion. That's something I can prove mathematically that he's a feckless coward. I'll go into court and testify that. I'll sit down with the FBI and tell them that. Like right? Like I feel confident in arguing that as a matter of fact rather than opinion.
Every other question you want your lawyer, but if they ask you that question,
yeah, no, he is absolutely like we can. Yes, I'm happy to tell you this. So, and it's this the thing that has been so disgusting with him is that he's this guy who clearly thought this would be an easy gig because he was running, like, you know, 2016. He was thinking Hillary was going to be national. Like, he'll be part of this big blue wave. He'll do his 4 years as the mayor of Portland, and then he'll move on to the governorship, or he'll go into Congress or whatever. And this will be part of his pathway, maybe to the presidency or to a cabinet position or something.
Sure.
And, you know, he winds up becoming mayor at a very difficult time to be mayor in Portland. And he completely fails to rise to the challenge and punts on every critical issue. And a tremendous number of people are hurt and a significant number of people are killed as a result of, is at least a partial result of his complete inability to sort of rise to and deal with the situation that he found himself in. And it's been very much the opposite for you and your colleagues. Like, you found yourself in this completely fucking unprecedented position. I feel confident saying no city council member of Minneapolis in recent memory has had to deal with something like this, right?
I mean, the closest I could think of is like the 08 crash, like the financial crash, right? Like, that's the closest.
Yeah.
And there wasn't a pandemic.
Yeah, right, and right. People didn't burn down the third precinct.
No, nobody burned down the police precinct. No.
So I think it's deeply honorable and impressive the way in which y'all have at least met this head on, right? Like, we'll see how it all works out in the end, but you didn't flinch from the fact that, like, you were in a position of power during a moment of historic import, and instead you tried to do something, and that's wonderful.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And I think that, like, you know, I can be an incredibly competitive person. You know, I think that, I don't know how you even run for office if you're not at least a little bit competitive. And so, you know, a part of me, like, is not quite ready to pat us on the back. Right. And, like, and I know that, like, you know, even as some of the arguments came out, like when we were pushing for the charter change, which all my colleagues, I think, on paper agree, it was the best direction to go, and allowed us a lot of flexibility. And I've seen just a number of my colleagues already start to buckle to this propaganda that somehow the increase in violence is linked to this discussion that we're trying to have, right? And I just, like, you know, and I think that this is winnable, right? Like, I think this is winnable, and I won't give myself any credit until we win it, until we just completely fail. I'm cautiously hopeful that people are ready to have this conversation. And when you think about, like, what we imagine the police to do and what they actually do, you know, there's this huge disconnect, right? Mm-hmm. One of my colleagues, I don't know if he would want to be named, so I won't name him, but one of my colleagues talked about, you know, sort of how the police expected his ride along to be this, like, eye-opening experience of, like, how hard their job was. And, you know, and, like, and what he discovered, you know, was just, like, how little accountability there is, right? And how much time is wasted. And also, you know, we have certain procedures. For instance, you know, if a cop gets shoved, they can basically press a button on their uniform, and every single cop in the city will go to them to help them with what they're dealing with.
With their crisis now, if you're shoved.
Yeah, right. And it's like, do people know that at any given moment in the middle of the night, like, they think that police are patrolling their neighborhood, but, like, maybe every single police in the city is, like, along the lake because some teenager headbutted a cop or something. You know, like, you know, it's like our practices are extremely inefficient. Our police's methods are extremely brutal. They demand zero accountability. And nothing has proven that more. You know, if we had even any cops at all who were out there publicly saying, you know, hey, you know what? We're not afraid of more oversight because we think what we do is totally on the up and up, then, like, that would sort of make, you know, I would have, I think, a harder conversation, you know, with my constituents or with myself about what the right thing to do is. But at every turn, our police union did this media blitz, and that was supposed to be sort of like their, oh my God, look at us, the council is picking on us. And they continued to make sort of gaffe after gaffe. One of the women was like, was asked a question about, we only have about 6 or 7% of our cops actually live in the city, right? Mm-hmm. And so 93-94% of our police officers on the Minneapolis Police Department don't live in the city.
Wow.
And she was asked a question, one of their union reps was asked a question, and she said, oh, well, like Minneapolis grocery store, I don't want to be at the grocery stores with my two beautiful girls and like running into rapists and murderers. And it's like, what do you think going to the grocery store in Minneapolis is like?
Yeah.
You
know, like, that doesn't, yeah.
That's rough.
It doesn't seem like you like this community very much.
No, not at all.
It doesn't seem like you consider yourself a part of this community.
Maybe yeah, right, attitude right. For somebody with a gun going around isn't great to have.
Absolutely. Mm. You know, Robert, you made a good point on one of your episodes from Behind the Police that was like, you know, police didn't even have guns as standard issue until like the 1940s. I'm quoting you, so I'm hoping your info's right on that.
Well, it was a bit earlier than that, but yeah, they didn't initially have firearms standard issued, like
right.
Especially even in the early 1900s. Yeah,
right. I mean, and so I think about like how difficult it is. Like once there's something about our collective imagination in terms of like what it means to be safe or what keeps us safe, that doesn't allow us to even reconsider fairly new concepts. I mean, the Minneapolis Police Department has only been in existence for about 150 years. I think it's 153 years. And so for 153 years, which in the grand scheme of things is not that long, we've basically done public safety one way. And we've never tried anything else. And yet, if you were to tell people, you know, what if we were to build a public safety system that wasn't this one, they just act like, you know, well, this is how they did it when Jesus was around. This is how we're doing it. I was like, well, not quite. Like, you know, like this, there's got to be other ways, you know. This wasn't like.
Yeah. Yeah. I think one of the things that really bums me out is, and this is like a broader issue for me, is the, is what's happened with television and broad, and I'm not trying to be like an old man, TV's corrupting kids, but like what is on television is a reflection of what we're able to imagine as a culture, right? And so, you know, in the 90s, we had you had shows like Star Trek, The Next Generation, which were like this really optimistic view about the future. And even before then, when I was a little kid, the show that my parents would show me, that was like their view of like this is how the country ought to operate was the Andy Griffith Show, which was a show about a sheriff named Andy Griffith in like small town America in like the 50s or something like that. And one of the things that was like one of the things about Andy as a sheriff is that he didn't carry a gun. And there were actually a couple of episodes that were all focused around the fact that he refused to carry a gun because he thought that if he went into a conflict situation carrying a gun, then people would see him as someone who was primarily there to use force to like make them comply. Mm. And that's not what he wanted to be, because his goal was to make his community safer. And so he thought that walking into situations with a gun actually made his community less safe. And so he didn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like one of the most popular shows on American television in like the 60s or whatever.
Yeah,
that's
a radical idea.
In no way would you get that on TV today. Like, you
no,
know,
no,
like,
no.
Like, it's not. And this is, again, this is obviously a time when like fucking everybody in Andy's town pretty much is a white person. So I'm not trying to say like the Andy Griffith Show was like some perfect, you know, but
right.
But the fact that back in those days you could have a show where it's like, wouldn't it be neat if cops didn't carry guns, and everybody's kind of like, yes, that is nice.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's just inconceivable that you would have a TV show, an American TV show about American cops who are unarmed.
There was an interview with Boots Riley where he was talking about how like you know, superhero films, which like I grew up on comics. I love like, you know, all the superhero films, but he said a lot of these superhero films are cop movies, right? They're 100% cop movies, and that has made it, you know, really mad at Boots Riley for saying that, because that has made it really difficult for me to enjoy superhero films. But I went back recently and I was watching like Batman Begins and The Dark Knight, and like, you know, those movies to me are now basically unwatchable, not because you know, there's the obvious sort of ridiculous premise of like Batman, Joker, these characters that are like whatever. But like, there are just these little assumptions that aren't supposed to be a part of the fantasy, right? Like Batman is supposed to be the fantasy and Scarecrow is supposed to be the fantasy part of the story. But there are these little things that aren't supposed to be a part of the fantasy but might be a little bit more fantasy than the concept of Batman. One of them is that like the treatment of like criminals in those movies is almost like, it's almost like being a criminal is encrypted into your DNA, right? Yeah. This idea, and so sometimes I'll hear constituents and the way that they talk about the homeless or the poor or people who commit crimes, and the way they talk about it just feels baffling to me, and I'm just like, I can't get on the same page with them. And then I watch Batman Begins and I'm like, oh, this is their concept of who a criminal is, right? This is what it's just this person who is inherently this way, doesn't matter their life circumstances. You know, that's why when I'm talking about a jobs program or whatever, or the economy, that sounds bizarre and besides the point to them. Because to them, the criminal is just sort of this inherent, you know, almost, you know, genetic thing within a person. And that when I got up there and said that we're going to dismantle the police department, all the criminals heard me and decided that I was giving them a free pass to go commit crimes. I mean, that's a really weird way to conceptualize why crime happens, in my opinion, right?
Yeah.
And so I think that like and so if we're up against the kind of mythology that Batman Begins encrypts into people. Then like that's a tall hill. It could be a pretty tall hill to overcome.
And not only that, there are criminals and they're just like that's how they are and that's how they're always going to be. But that also there will always be crime. Like not only is that embedded in the criminals, but crime is embedded in our communities. And there's nothing to do about it other than well, you stop them and you put them in jail.
Oh,
and then if they get out, well, they're going to do another crime because there's always going to be criminals. There's no solution to it really.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I had a police officer say to me, he called me and we kind of got into an argument and he was like, he had made a statement that I had actually applauded him for, like a couple of months ago. He had made a statement saying something like, you know, 3-6% of cops shouldn't be cops. And I remember at the time I was like, oh man,
that's almost like a revolutionary thing for a cop to admit these days.
Right, right, right.
That
right.
number could be a little higher, but
Right. So I remember, so then like a couple months later, you know, he's calling me because he was upset about my position around dismantling the police department. And we're having this conversation and he says, oh, you know me, you know, Jeremiah, like I'm gonna call it like I see it. I'm gonna say whatever I wanna say. You know, I stood up there and said that 3-6% of cops shouldn't be cops, and the same way that you know 3-6% of the community needs to be locked up. I was like,
whoa, hey!
I was like,
hey!
I was like, that is
those are different statements. Those are not the same.
I was like, no,
oh,
man,
boy,
not
I don't
at
like
all.
That.
Not at all. And this is coming from an officer who. You know, I think prior to that conversation, I would say like kind of gets it better than most officers, right?
Yeah. Sure. The fact that he's willing to admit that a significant portion of police shouldn't be police is, again, something. Yeah.
Right. Right. Right.
Yeah.
And but so if a guy who kind of gets it is getting it that wrong,
yeah.
Like what do we think those guys you know in the squad cars are saying, doing, thinking?
Yeah.
It's unreformable. In my opinion.
Yeah. 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 You have some, you know, it's the hammer, it's the hammer nail thing, except for like the problem that what we're trying to do here is like, we're trying to like polish glass or whatever. And it's like, well, you know, sometimes you have hammers that are better than others, but none of them are the right tools for this job.
Right. Right.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess the last thing I'm really curious about is, and I don't know if this has been something y'all have dealt with or not, but folks get angry when you talk about things like getting rid of police forces. It's extremely politicized right away. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, did y'all deal with any of that sort of like internet hate mob stuff coming down on your heads after your big vote went very viral?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, some of us more so than others, you know, mm-hmm. I remember, you know, I probably was getting more hate mail than I probably ever have gotten. Most of it virtual, but then I got some things sent to my house. And then it was funny because I like told my dad about it. It was like, oh yeah, like I got hate mail sent to the house. And then like a few hours later, I got a call and the FBI was like, we're going to come pick up that hate mail from your house. So I'm like, oh, that's weird. I don't know if I want, FBI at my house. Right. But they came and picked up the hate mail and you know, who knows what they're going to do with it. But yeah, certainly. And some of it can be pretty scary. I know that I'm lucky enough to like have a good relationship with my neighbors. I have a lot of friends who are legally armed themselves, who are like, hey, look, you know, you're out there doing patrols at night. Like, we'll post up at your house and make sure that nothing shady is going on. But not all of my colleagues had that. And, you know, there was a lot of my colleagues got some flack, you know, because they accepted, you know, some private security when they were getting very specific death threats. And I was offered that same security. I turned it down because, again, I just had this network that was willing to sort of do some of that work. And, you know, and I think that some of the flack is probably unwarranted, because when you're getting death threats, and especially if you're a city council person, you know, look, most of us got into this because we're looking to, like, you know, we're dealing with zoning laws, you know, we're like, you know, we're doing, like, most of them are like community planners. I'm a muralist, you know. And so when you start getting death threats, it's hard to know exactly what your next move should be. Yeah. And so a lot of that was scary for a lot of my colleagues, some of whom did accept some private security. But again, it all ended up amounting to just a lot of hot air. But you never want to just assume that nobody's going to make good on some of the threats that you get.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah, you have no idea what yeah, is hot air and what isn't.
That's the stressful thing about those threats, is that, like, right. You just can't know.
Yeah, yeah. Right. So yeah, so I know like everybody was like, I was at first not taking it very seriously, but I had told a few friends just sort of like, hey, this is a crazy thing that happened. And then immediately, just like a bunch of my friends were like, armed, posted up outside of my house. Like, I'm like, okay, all right, I appreciate you guys. I don't know if this is necessary, but I appreciate it. So yeah. Yeah.
Well, all right. Jeremiah, I think we're, that's everything I had to ask. Yeah.
Thank you so much for your time. This was a great conversation.
Yeah.
And for having those conversations with people individually. That's where the real convincing happens.
Yeah.
Thank you for taking concerted action to try to improve the material conditions of human beings on planet Earth.
Also, just to our listeners, I want to point out, this is such a good example of someone getting involved on a local level, you know.
Exactly, yeah.
And changing politics and doing the incremental work, and sometimes the drastic work, you know, that it takes to change public opinion, to move the needle. It's vital. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, and I think that there are, right before hopping on this call with you all, I was on a call with a couple of council members from Seattle and Austin, who are all trying to move, you know, similar things to us here in Minneapolis. And I think that, like, if folks are looking for, you know, I'm not going to promise that every, you know, every city has that person that is really pushing hard. I have no idea. But I know that there are a lot of cities. There are some folks in New York. There are some folks, you know, in Chicago that are, like, you know, again, city councils, it's not the sexy work of, like, being in Congress or even being in, like, a state house or state assembly. But there are probably some really radical folks quietly pushing. And so find those folks, because they're going to instill a little bit of hope, and they're going to be maybe more courageous. And often a lot of folks at the local level, certainly there are folks at the local level who are careerists, but often, you know, that city council member is not just some careerist. They're willing to take some big risks, say a big thing, say a radical thing. So I encourage people to find whoever that is in their city.
Can you tell our listeners where they can find you online or promote anything you want to promote?
So I'm Jeremiah Ford North on Twitter. They're welcome to friend me on Facebook or follow my page, you know, Jeremiah Ellison for Ward 5. And I don't think I have anything to promote, just you know, other than vote in November.
Yep.
And you know, and I guess, you know, if folks opt not to vote, I'm not going to shame anybody. I don't think that works, but I do think that you know, it's an important thing to do. I'm the chair of the Elections and Rules Committee in my city, so I kind of have to advocate for people voting. So,
well, thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you again. And you can check us out online as well, at Worst Year Pod on Instagram and Twitter. You know who we are on Twitter. Mm-hmm. It'll be in the tweets.
Yeah, you're aware of us.
You're aware by
now.
Don't
pretend you're not.
You know, it's you fine. Love it. You yeah. love to see it. All right, this took a
All
turn.
Right, well, we're done.
Thank you, Jeremiah. Yeah.
And oh, last thing I wanted to say is my sister really appreciated the Phyllis Schlackley episodes.
Find the bastards. Yeah.
Yeah. So just wanted to put that plug in. So she had learned about Phyllis Schlackley when she was in college and was like, oh, somebody else knows
what
about
what a monster.
Person.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
yeah. Well, all right. That's the episode. Everyone go get elected to your city council and remove your own city's police departments. Go do it right now.
Do it.
Before the day is done. Like, this, no excuses. Get out there and do it. Come on.
Clock's ticking.
Everything's so dumb. Everything's so dumb, and it's gonna get dumber.
Great.
I tried.
Yes.
Daniel?
Lovely.
Worst Year Ever is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.